At the beginning, it was a book about quality, and it ended up being a book about leadership. But if you take those high-level principles, if you take the idea of a quality narrative and making sure that we're really trying to understand how are people thinking and looking at the narrative inside our business right now, it gives you a guidance for how you're going to have to think about that influence.
Welcome to the People Stack podcast, where we discuss the intersection of people, work, and technology. I'm your host, Jen Bunk. I am a career coach for tech managers and CEO of the People Stack. My guest for this episode is Ronald Cummings John. He is co-founder at Global App Testing and author of a book that's going to be coming out in a couple of months called Leading Quality. Welcome, Ronald. So excited to have you here.
Hey, I'm super pumped to be on this show.
Yeah, so let's kick this off. First, let's get to know you a little bit more and what you do. So you wear many hats, author, co-founder, organizer of hackathons. What I'd like to hear about is what's your overarching mission that ties all of these together?
Well, I think when we first started, we personally had a whole lot of issues dealing with quality. In actual fact, one of the first companies my co-founder and I ran together was a search engine for beauty products. And as we were building out this search engine for beauty products, we basically had so many issues related to quality. And one day we sat down and we were like, hold on, I think dealing with quality is a bigger problem than finding the right beauty product. And so we ended up doing what our investors sometimes call the mother of all pivots. And we adjusted the company to being a testing company. We started to build out a testing company from there. And so I think since that begun many years ago, the real thing that has driven us is the fact that when we help people with quality in their products, we're not just helping that person who owns a product. We're actually helping all the people that use that product. So imagine the impact that we have as a team when we work with companies like Facebook or Google or any of those guys, because we effectively are impacting the experience of billions of people. And so when you have that as like the underlying thought that's running through your head, I think it's quite easy to be driven to just working out how to make quality better. And then I guess, you know, from there we ended up doing things like Testathons, which is a hackathon for testers. And then recently writing this book. And I think it all comes down to us personally wanting to be better at what we do and help people around us be better at what they do. Because I think that thread ties along all of them as you think about them.
Yeah. So I absolutely hear the quality piece of it and how when you focus on quality, it can positively affect so many constituents in so many positive ways, not just the product, the engineers, the company, but also the end users as well, which then, you know, has this positive effect on just so many other different areas once you start spreading it out to consumers and users. It's such a wonderful message and absolutely worthy of a book. So your book coming out is Leading Quality Lessons from 120 Plus Tech Companies About Delivering Great Software. So can you let us know when it's coming out? Is there a release date, like month and year?
It is going to be September time is when the physical launch comes out. But I think there's a special launch we have just before that for kind of special guests and friends who get the book for free just before that. So there's kind of two launch parties happening for the book.
Okay. So we're looking at August 2019 and September 2019.
Yep.
That's wonderful. Just in case some folks are listening to this and that time may have come and that time may have already passed to definitely check out that book. So is that what inspired you to write the book? That basically the focus on quality and we really need to have more of a conversation around what quality means.
Do you know what the truth is? That's not even where it started. It started because we would work with all of these cool companies. You know, we pretty much ended up running a company that tests for most of the applications on your phone. And so when we'd meet new people, they'd be asking us, what do you think our QA strategy should be? How do you think we should look at it? And so instead of us deciding to answer this one by one to every person that came to us, we were like, hey, why don't we just write a book on this? So my co-founder, a guy called Awais Peer, and I said, we're going to write a book on this subject, it should only take about 6 months, just as a quick side project. Mm-hmm. And I think you fast forward 2.5 years later, and we've only now got to the point where the book is finished. And I think the reason why it ended up taking so long is because at first we thought we'd be writing a book about quality itself.
Okay. And
as we met all of these founders and VPs of engineers and directors of quality across all these different ranges of companies, we actually discovered that we needed to write a book about leading quality inside a company, because we would find that there were a set of people who would talk about quality, but every time they spoke about it, it was at such an operational level that no one in the business was paying enough attention.
Okay.
So we were asking ourselves, how do you get a message about quality to a higher level audience? And how do you support people in these positions of VP of engineering or head of test or something inside an organization? How do we write a book that supports them thinking about strategically, how do I look at quality inside my company? Because you're now dealing with a whole different set of problems. You're basically dealing with the intersection of work, people, and technology, just like you say, because you're now looking at things like, hey, what is what we call the quality narrative inside our company? You know, and I guess this actually applies whether you are in an engineering or a testing related role or anything else. There is always a narrative around your department. And so when it comes to quality, there's three core narratives that we found ended up coming up. Mm-hmm. First one is what you call an ownership narrative, which is, who owns quality inside this company? Is quality the responsibility of the QA or the testing department or the people inside that org? Or is it the responsibility of everybody? And I like to think that the only way to really make quality really work is when everyone understands the role that they play in developing a quality product. And that doesn't just extend to the sort of engineering-y teams, etc. It can extend all the way to the customer support team. If you've got a customer support team and they're there and they're receiving tickets about problems and issues, how is that then taken out of the customer support team and directed back into the product? That responsibility of ensuring they have a better quality product still sits with that customer support team. And so the first narrative is about who owns quality inside that company.
Yep.
The second narrative is this, how do you actually do testing? And it's really going, what is the right way to look at quality and testing inside this company? Do we utilize what we've seen and say when we were listening to a podcast or when someone went to a talk? I often find that people go to conferences and they come back super excited about new ideas of how they could implement quality and testing inside their company, but yet it doesn't get implemented correctly. And that's because they don't always have the context about why that form of testing or that idea was used in the company that they have seen the example in. Mm-hmm. And so how to actually test becomes a narrative that needs to be controlled by people. And I think this kind of narrative exists no matter what department you're in. So let's say you're in a HR department. People across the business have a narrative in their own mind of what is the best way that HR should run. Mm-hmm. And I was reading an article today where, you know, some people believe that HR is there to protect people and to like cuddle people. And others have a view that, you know, HR is about how do you help your managers become better managers so that you have a better organization as a whole. Sure. But depending on what that narrative is will depend on how so many people perceive and work with the department. So how's a test narrative become super important for how you look at quality. And then the third and final narrative is the idea of the value narrative, which is, how do you display and show the value that QA and quality teams provide to companies? Now, in the quality industry, a lot of the time people talk about, you know, we should be doing testing or we should focus on quality because it helps us with risk mitigation. So it helps make sure that problems don't happen in the future. But that's not really showing the absolute value that's possible. from quality. Whereas I've seen many times in companies where the value narrative is about the fact that that quality team can actually help revenue generation and identifying revenue potential for the company. I remember one story that a company that we worked with, they were doing a test in Indonesia. And when the test was running, a tester ended up reporting a bug that said, when I sign up to this application, it requires me to have a first name, a last name, and an email address. But it shouldn't require for me to have a last name or a surname. And at first, that's very confusing for most people. But when you understand the Indonesian demographic and population, you understand that 40% of the population don't have surnames. And so in that particular location, that is a bug for them. It's an issue in that country. And so when the company ended up fixing that issue, they saw their sign-up growth skyrocket. And so it was like, wow, quality can connect to company growth. About that, right? And I think it's important in any department that you're in that people have that appreciation for the value that your department provides, even if it's not the sales team.
Yeah. So often people get focused on and hyper-focused and almost tunnel visioned by, well, it's just sales that's really driving the company growth. But at the end of the day, there's so many other pieces to it, including bugs or lack of bugs, making sure that it's a quality product in all of these different ways. And this is just wonderful thinking about quality this way, these three different narratives: ownership, how do you test it, and then the value, what value do quality QA teams provide? And so that's super helpful, super valuable. What I'd like to do though is take a step back, and I think that in some ways, you've already answered this question, Ronald, but just for folks who might need something else to wrap their heads around, let's take even a step back from there, and not just like the narratives, but this may seem like a really simple question, but I know that there's going to be a complex answer involved here. What is quality? How would you define quality in the way that you're approaching it?
That is a wonderfully loaded question.
Don't you love it? Yes, those are the questions I love to ask.
Look, you know, when I think about quality, it's the need to define quality itself is a philosopher's game, because no one has a unanimous agreement on, you know, what is quality? How do I know if my product is actually quality, of a level of quality or not? And I think that there are two things that everyone definitely agrees on, which also just adds to the complexity of its definition, right? So the first one is that quality in and of itself is subjective, which means it's determined by whoever is using that product at that time. You know, if you, like, I sometimes compare the experiences that we have. If you go back to the dial-up days of the internet, and what we considered quality in an application at that time is very different to what we consider quality in an application now. Mm-hmm. And so, and my perception personally of quality would be very different to your perception of quality when we look at the same thing. And so the fact that quality is subjective and it's also relative, depending on, like, it's relative in time and space, that's what makes it difficult to define. Now, there are people who have defined it in ways that I like. So there's a gentleman called Michael Bolton, and he says that quality is value to some person at some time who matters. Mm-hmm. And I kind of like that. I get and empathize that it's basically saying that the definition of quality can vary. And it depends on what you're referring to when you're talking about quality. And that's what makes it so hard as a thing. You know, because if you speak to any exec in a company and they're like, you know, do you think it's important to have a high quality product? They'll be like, yes, of course we do. Quality is the most important thing for us. We're always, we focus on quality in everything we do. But then if you ask them, you know, what has been your actual investment in the quality of your application today, it might draw a little bit of a blank. And so it's one of those things that we all, from a nebulous level, understand, but yeah, pinpointing it is quite challenging. And I guess that's also what makes the QA, the quality industry itself, a challenging one for people to understand its value. And that's why, once again, the value narrative was such an important part of how we believe people in the QA quality space should be thinking about how they talk about how they represent their departments.
Yeah, yeah. And so is that the second thing that people agree on? You had mentioned that there's at least a couple of things, and one of them is that quality is subjective. Would the second thing be that
I think number one was that the quality is subjective, and the second is that it's relative, which means it changes over time.
Okay, so those are the two different things. Yeah. Yes. Guy, I absolutely hear. I hear that. Different people, different times, different context, different quality. Absolutely hear you on that. And I love kind of chewing apart, peeling back the layers of concepts like this, like quality, that there really isn't. That we know what it is when we see it, when we feel it, when we hear it, when we use it. But it's really hard to quantify, to measure, and to test. And so, to that end, to the testing narrative, one of the things that I wanted to ask you about, because you also do test-a-thons. So I'd love to learn about what they are. You know, so what are test-a-thons and why are they needed?
Yeah, so I think it was when we had first started the company, the QA industry didn't sound like the sexiest industry, you know? It didn't sound like people were having fun on yachts and boats in the QA world. And if I think about my own experience of progressing in the early days when I used to code, I used to love going to hackathons. Oh my goodness, they were so cool. Because as a developer, you would meet loads of cool people. You'd be learning so much from the people that ended up being in your group. There was unlimited free food. There was tons of swag. It was just a lot of fun.
Yeah.
But then when we came to the QA world, we didn't see that same level of celebration for the craft. And so we were like, we're fun people. How do we make that happen outside of us? How do we bring a bit more of that liveliness that we have here in our day to day to the community as such? And so I remember we did the first ever test-a-thon in London, and we had the King.com team who make Candy Crush. They were the app that we were testing at the time. But the day before the event, the internet went down in the building that we were supposed to be doing it. Now, obviously the internet going down is a tragedy anywhere in the world, but sure. It's even more of a tragedy when you're trying to set up a test-a-thon, because yes, basically you have a lot of people that need the internet and have lots of devices connected to the internet. And so we were like racking our hair out, and I think somewhere like 1 a.m. in the morning, they let us know that they finally had got the internet back up, and we ended up doing it. And the main thing that we wanted out of that was to create an event that wasn't you just hearing a lecture, because we've all been to conferences and lectures where we've just been on our phones checking our emails. And so we were trying to ask, how do we make it so that you can still learn something, but it's more interactive and fun? And so, you know, the experience being to hackathons, we were like, is it possible to do a hackathon but for testers? And then we worked out that dynamic, and the event just ended up delivering against everything that we could ever dream, which was, it was a whole lot of people that had a lot of fun. We made it an entertaining day. There was so much networking in terms of people talking to each other, making new connections, learning how other people look at testing. And then everyone learned something. You know, people came away having learned new things about how they should look at quality and how they should test, and ideas that they could take back. And over the years, as we now do them around the world, we've kind of worked out a model that really makes sure that it is something that people can learn, network, and have fun from. And we really try to push those three elements as much as possible. But it's not something that we get to do every day. It is, it's the kind of thing that we get to sometimes do on a weekend. But when we do it, it's lots of fun to do. And it's just lots of fun to see across the whole world the different states of quality in different companies. Because we will go to, say, Africa, and we'd talk to the QA teams over there, and they would have such a different perception of quality, and the way how their teams are viewed internally is different from maybe some of the more progressive ways that I've seen quality teams being talked about and utilized here in say, the UK.
Okay.
So almost as we began doing that journey around the world, this kind of desire to increase the education around looking at QA from a value perspective just really started to take hold.
And I love the fun aspect of it, right? So I was thinking about, okay, how would we know that this is a successful, a valuable testathon? Okay, we learned something, we've got educated about what quality is and different ways that we could test it, but also we had some fun, we had some free food, we celebrated the fact that this is what we do and we love it. Not everybody may love it, not everybody may understand our form of geek, but we wanna do this and we wanna get better, and so let's get together and let's do this and have some fun in the process.
So I was just thinking, one thing that runs through my mind is that in any craft that anyone has, there is nothing more joyous than meeting people that have the same geek as you.
Yeah.
You know, when you just get to talk to people that understand inherently the things that annoy you and piss you off, the desires that you have of where you want to go, there is something about that camaraderie that I think is incredible.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's part of celebrating, isn't it? Right. That we celebrate and we say, oh, wow, this is so great that we're together. But we can vent a little bit as well, you know, in a joyful way and in a making fun of kind of way, but that no one else could understand the frustrations and and, you know, the things that make you want to pull your hair out. Nobody else would understand it except, you know, like in this case, other QA testers. That's a really great point about any kind of time when you're bringing together people from a very similar community, especially when we're talking about finding it so specifically like QA testers. And so what I'm curious about is when you do this, when you organize these, are they usually people from the same company or are you bringing people together from different companies?
So it's usually people from lots of different locations in the country. And so they're from completely different companies. They don't know each other. And it's kind of funny because we all remember what the first day of school's like, right? You enter a building. I don't really know anyone. You're nervously looking around. But by the end of it, you've got everyone chatting, mingling, and you can see that relationships are being built. And I think that's you know, when I go to conferences and you ask me what was the best bit about the conference, it's normally the people I met. I think it's rare that I go to a conference and I'm like, you know, that talk was absolutely life-changing. And if I didn't see that live, as opposed to watching it on YouTube like a week later, I don't know what I would have done with myself. Yeah. But really, it's the relationships you build. And once again, when you've got those people around you who are of your same ilk, those relationships are actually easier to build because you're all on the same path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Hi, everyone. We'll get back to the interview in a jiffy. But first, are you a tech manager? In other words, do you lead teams of geeks through long-term complex projects? Do you feel like you're wasting precious time going to useless meetings, dealing with administrative nonsense, and working late nights? Are you working 50 plus hours a week, but don't have the salary to show for it? It doesn't need to be that way. you can build thriving, high-performing teams who produce a measurable positive impact while earning the premium salary you deserve. Oh, and you don't have to work your butt off to get there. If this sounds like the kind of success you're striving for, then go to jenbunk.com/webinar to reserve a spot in my free masterclass. I share the 4 shifts that my tech manager clients made to achieve badass career transformation. That's jenbunk.com/webinar. Without further ado, please enjoy the rest of the interview.
And it's so great that you're doing this, and you're clearly so excited about it, and it's a passion for you. And so is this like one of the main things that you're focusing on right now, like as a company, or is this more of a side job? How do you kind of fit it in the grand scheme of things in terms of everything that you're doing? Just curious from as a career coach, I'm always curious about, you know, the different hats that people wear and how you kind of identify with a particular area, particularly this, the testathon piece of it.
So I think that the main focus for us is always going to be building our global app testing, which is a core company. But any opportunity that you get to spend time with more people is valued.
Yeah, I hear that. Yeah, it's kind of the reason why I do this podcast. It's not the core piece of my business. The career coaching is, like, for you, it's the global app testing. But yeah, it's a way to relatively easily meet lots of people, not in person. In person is certainly the best, you know, conferences and stuff like that. But just bringing a group of people together who otherwise wouldn't have been. So that's great. I can absolutely relate to that. Yeah. So switching gears a little bit, Ronald, I wanted to talk a little bit more about your connections in your interviews with over 120 plus engineering QA leaders from Facebook, from Google, from Airbnb, from Snapchat, just about what you learned from these multiple conversations with technical leaders. Can you, and I know this is a hard question, but can you give us a sense of some of the main things that you learned from these conversations with technical leaders?
So yeah, of course. The ones that I think are the most interesting and I'd say impactful, and I choose these ones because there are things that we all hear every day. You know, like I understand that there's a conversation, do I do manual testing or do I do more automated forms of testing? That's a general theme and conversation that happens in the quality world. But the things that I was super interested in was, you know, number one, that whole idea of the quality narrative and that understanding that if you're going to be a leader, you have to try and set and control the way that people are talking about and thinking about quality inside your company. But what all of them highlighted is that obviously that's not as straightforward. Anyone that has tried to create any change in any company has found it challenging. And so one thing that I truly loved that we witnessed when we were talking with everybody is how much the great leaders in the technical space studied the ability to persuade and influence. Mm-hmm. And we would always ask people at the start of the interview, you know, what books are you reading? And not like once you hit that level of being like in the leadership realm, they weren't talking about hands-on books about engineering or testing. They were all talking about management, people, persuasion, influence. And I was like, that's completely true when you think about it. Because when you hit that part of your career, all of those things are more important and almost are a bigger part of your day-to-day. And there's a book called To Sell as Human by Daniel Pink. And I think it's a great book. It's one of the books that I recommend to everyone to read.
Yeah.
And while he was writing the book, he did a study. And he found that even people who are not in a sales-based role spend about 40% of their time having to engage in some form of persuasion, influence, convincing others. Mm-hmm. And even if you just reflect, like, outside of work, how much of your time is spent convincing, persuading your children, your spouse, your parents, of just to do something in a way that you think it should be done? Yes. And so I felt that was incredibly powerful, that a strong part of our careers as we develop is learning these skills. But the problem that exists is that when we have, and when I see people that come from more technical backgrounds, they don't want to be thought of as salespeople. You know, they're like, well, I don't really sell. I'm not the salesperson. And because of that, the idea of having to sell becomes dirty, because if you spend a lot of your time in a logical like career path, in terms of like using logic on your day to day, you assume that just because you made a logical argument that everybody should agree.
Yeah.
But then that's not what actually happens. And so learning and understanding those skills was something that I thought was particularly interesting from the people that we spoke with. And then the other thing that I found incredibly interesting was the idea of something called a growth metric. Now, a growth metric is a single metric that companies use that they believe will help them grow in their company. So there are different types of growth metrics that you might have in a company. So for example, if you look at companies like Facebook, they focus very much on number of daily active users.
Yep.
And as a business, what they want to do is increase the number of daily active users on their site, on their platform. Mm-hmm. Whereas you might have a company like Airbnb where their core focus is the number of nights that are booked. And they want to make sure that people book nights. And so when you think about those examples, how do you tie the work that your quality team does to those metrics? And have you ever related them? And when we talk to people outside of like the core set of people that were interviewed, a lot of people had never really looked at how are they going to use that company level metric and how they're going to look at the work that they're doing and adjust the way that they think about their work to see how can they support that metric. So if you have like 100 bugs sitting in your backlog, how do you choose which ones you should be working on, looking at, or fixing? Well, potentially assessing which one of those might help move our company's growth metric means that you can add more value to that company than if you just decided to try and fix them free willy nilly. And that whole principle of looking at your day-to-day work, no matter where you are in an organization, and just trying to ask yourself, what can I do in my role that's going to contribute towards that core level growth metric that's going to move and support this company? I thought that was incredibly powerful.
It is. It absolutely is. And not just for QA folks, for anyone who works for a company, no matter what level that you're at. And that involves knowing, first of all, what their growth metrics are. What are the key metrics, the key performance indicators for that organization? You know, what do we value the most? And a lot of times, especially as you get lower and lower down into the individual contributor levels, they're not able to answer that question. And I think related to the leadership piece of it, this is related to the leadership, because I certainly believe that it's the role of a leader to make sure that this is communicated throughout the organization, but that it's also the individual's role to take ownership and say, hey, I'm going to find out about this. Not just so that I can help the company grow, because that's awesome, that's cool, but that I can feel more connected to what it is that I'm doing on a day-to-day basis. So it's so powerful, that connection piece, connecting the dots.
Yeah, and I think that became the irony, you know, when I think back to when we first started this idea of writing this book, where at the beginning it was a book about quality and it ended up being a book about leadership, But if you take those high level principles, if you take the idea of a quality narrative and making sure that we're really trying to understand how are people thinking and looking at the narrative inside our business right now. And sometimes we tell people to go and ask three people inside their company, what do they hear as the narrative of the quality narrative inside the company? So what are they hearing people say about quality? Oftentimes when you ask a third someone, what do they hear? They'll tell you what they think, but it gives you the sort of knowledge of what do other people think about, so that you can start to work on what is going to be your blockers for adjusting that narrative, or what are going to be the things that you're going to need to work on a lot more, or the potential support that you might need. And it gives you a guidance for how you're going to have to think about that influence. And so that first idea about narrative, that the idea about influencing and persuading people, and then this idea of aligning what your team is doing and what you're doing towards a core growth metric, they're principles that work for any team leader, right?
Yep.
But Absolutely. It just so happens that we were looking at how do you be great from a inserting quality into your company. Because we also believe that, you know, if you focus on quality inside your company, you're going to have happier customers, which means you'll generate more revenue, which means your business will be 10x more successful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's absolutely an important piece of the puzzle. And again, I absolutely want to recognize you for bringing this more to the front, a conversation that has kind of, at least in my experience anyway, you know, QA and QA testing is kind of left in the corners, you know, like even almost physically in the corners, like when you go to a networking party or something, all the QA testing guys are over there. I don't know what they're talking about. You know what I mean? And we joke about it, but it's like, all right, well, how can we kind of weave this narrative together a little bit more? And that's what I love about this. And we've definitely covered lots of important topics around QA and testing. And so what I'd like to end with, the last question that I have for you, Ronald, is a question that I ask all of my podcast guests. So I'd love to hear what your thoughts on this are. And the question is, what is the biggest people-related challenge that you face in your career?
I think there's probably two. Can I have two? Is that allowed? I don't know.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Boom. Okay. So I think the first one is the recognition that great communication just takes longer than planned.
Yeah.
So if you truly wanted to give everyone the context for why you said something, what you really in your heart just want to tell someone in like a sentence basically is a 20 minute detailed conversation. And so I say that's a people related challenge, because communication is a people related challenge. You know, as long as you have more than one person having to communicate, there's a problem, because something's going to get missed. And attached to that, of what I consider the other problem, is clarifying a vision. And when I talk about a vision, I mean, a vision is something that might not exist. You know, as leaders of companies and departments, we often have to paint a vision of the future that doesn't yet exist inside our companies.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you paint that vision so clearly that another person's mind can see it exactly in the way that it is in your mind?
That's right.
So I find that one of the biggest challenges, but also one of the most fascinating ideas of like leadership.
Yes.
That is, which is painting a vision so clear into someone's mind that they can see what's in your mind.
Yeah, that's something that I absolutely see as a challenge as well in terms of what I do, and certainly with the, you know, the clients who we serve. And it reminds me of a quote that basically goes something like, only those that can see the invisible can achieve the impossible.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what leaders do, right? It's about, okay, we're doing things that other people may think or may say is impossible because they can't see it yet. But that it's our job as leaders to have that vision in our head so clear that we see it like a movie, playing like a movie in our mind's eye, and getting it to that level. And then that's when you're going to be able to communicate to others and say, this is where we're going, everyone. Come with me. It's so, so powerful. And then the other piece of it, great communication takes longer than planned. Ah, gosh, as much as like, I love being concise and I love concise communicators, that is not a strength of mine. So this challenge makes me feel better, right? That especially when we're talking about adding multiple people here, I repeat myself all the time. Ask anybody who's ever worked with me, like broken record, here we go again, but that's powerful. So what would you say though to the people who would be like, all right, I get it, Ronald. You know, we want to make sure that we take our time about communication, but what about, okay, there is absolutely a power in being concise as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I can't remember who said it, but someone said, if I had more time, I would have written a shorter letter.
yeah.
And really it's the same thing. You know, the more time you have to refine a message, the shorter it can become. But the thing that you have no control over is what is already in existence in that person's mind. So even though you may be concise, that may not mean they have the full understanding of exactly what you were referring to. And even though you may have been concise, they still may have questions, which means your initial explanation didn't actually cover everything. And it's not to say that every time you speak to someone, you have to have pre-answered every single permutation of question. I mean, that would be pretty boring for everybody. But I think concise communication is a fallacy that I, you know, even as I talk out loud, I don't think it truly exists. You know, people talk about the elevator pitch. And the point of an elevator pitch isn't so that you can stop talking. It's so that you have more time to talk.
Yeah.
Right? I guess that's what I mean when I say great communication takes longer than you plan, because you may think that, I'm now super concise, I've done my elevator. But in order for that person to truly understand, you're going to have to go deeper.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we can look at, for example, the elevator pitch as a way to start a conversation, but it's not the end. But it can be powerful. Oh, wow, that's great. You're able to pitch your value in 10 seconds. Okay. But I really need to take a second to let that sink in. Because that's wonderful. You're great. But I have questions. And so, yeah, I could absolutely relate to that piece of it. And I'm wondering, can you think of examples? I'm trying to think of examples from, you know, from my world, or just examples of team leading and leadership where that happens, where the leader says something that's so inspiring and so concise, but then the team says, oh, that's great, but I have questions, right? it happens. So it happens so often.
Did you say, can I think of a time?
Yeah, can you think of examples? Like I don't know, like a specific story.
I think it happens all the time. You
yeah,
know?
That's true. Can you think of a time? Sure. What was one of those times? Can you share one of them?
It's such a normal thing. I don't think it warrants having a particular example, because I think every time that anyone makes any message and the media ask a question around it publicly,
yeah,
that's because there's additional context that needs to be added, etc. So I think it's every time. Every time that we communicate, there is additional information to be added.
Sure.
Later on.
Yeah. Yeah, I absolutely, touche on that. I think that the reason that I went there is because it's almost like I never thought of it that way, you know? And so that's a shift in thinking around communication, because so often we get tied up in, how do I communicate this message? How do I do this? How do I say that? And we forget that the purpose that we communicate is so that other people can hear and understand. And so, of course, right? It's never just you say something and you turn around and you leave, right? It's every time. That's the definition of communication, right?
Yeah. And I say all of this, and I never want people to hear this and go, he's either the best communicator in the world or he thinks he's the best communicator in the world. I often say to my team, let's all start with the assumption that we're shit at communicating.
Yeah.
Because then if someone doesn't explain something to you, it's not because they were intending to not give you info. It's because they weren't the greatest communicator. So I've just come to the assumption that we're all terrible at communicating. And therefore, if I don't truly understand something or I don't have the full context of something, then I probably should just ask for extra information. And they weren't withholding it for any other reason than they didn't know that I needed that additional information.
Yeah. Yeah. So if we start with that assumption, we'll all be better communicators through that, right? Instead of assuming that people understood and getting offended if it's people take things the wrong way, that it's just, okay, people are going to need context. People are going to need whatever beliefs that they have, that maybe that you're challenging a belief that they had that you didn't even realize that you are. Yeah, and so it's going to peel back some of the layers that way. So I love so much about that. And it's a shift in thinking around communication that I think is absolutely warranted and absolutely.
And I just want to point out, I am not saying that you shouldn't practice communication. You shouldn't be better at being more concise. You shouldn't have a better opening message. That's not the point of what I've said. Yeah. My point was, it's just that all great communicating involves more communication than you realize. So even if you are incredibly concise, there will be additional questions from people around you that they will need for them to truly get that vision in their mind of what you're talking about.
Absolutely. I hear you loud and clear on that. And it's such an important message for all of us, no matter what it is that we do, whether we're QA testers or software engineers or other kind of technical leaders or in any kind of leadership position. Mm-hmm. So with that, Ronald, it's just around time to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time today. Again, I encourage folks to check out Ronald's book, which will be coming out as of today, in a couple of months, but by the time you're listening to this, it absolutely may be out, Leading Quality. So definitely check that out.
If they go to leadingqualitybook.com, that's where they'll find all the information on the book.
Great. So that's why I was going to ask if you have any other resources to share with people about finding out about the book. And if people are interested in following you and following more about what you have to say, what would be the best way for people to connect and find out about you?
If you want to find out about what we do in our company at Global App Testing, where we have a crowd of 20,000 plus testers that help support people scale up their testing globally, you can go to globalapptesting.com. If you want to find out about the book, you can go to leadingqualitybook.com. And if you want to find out about me, you could probably just ping me on LinkedIn, Ronald Cummings John, CUMMINGS-JOHN.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Ronald. It's been wonderful connecting with you and having a really, really valuable conversation with you today about QA, yes, but lots of other important topics too, like leadership and communication. So thank you again for your time today. It's been a pleasure.
Hey, it's been awesome chatting with you. Thank you for the time.